July 2004. John? John, are you home? She was sure that he wasn't, but being sure of anything these days was tattered with too many holes to contain the meaning that it used to. He'd left to go somewhere, but she couldn't remember when he left or where he was going. Did he run to the store for milk or coffee? Did he go out to rent a movie? If either were the case, he'd be back any minute. Or did he drive back up to Cambridge, in which case he'd be gone for at least several hours and possibly the night? Or did he decide, at last, that he couldn't face what lay ahead for them, and he just plain left, never to return? No, he wouldn't do that. She was sure of it. Their Chatham Cape, built in 1990, felt bigger, more open, and less compartmentalized than their house in Cambridge. She walked into the kitchen. It was nothing like their kitchen at home. The bleached effect of the white painted walls and cabinets, white appliances, white bar stools, and white tile floor was broken up only slightly by the soapstone countertops and splashes of cobalt blue in various white ceramic and clear glass containers. It looked like a coloring book page that had been only tentatively filled in with a single blue crayon. The two plates and used paper napkins on the island counter displayed evidence of salad and a spaghetti and red sauce dinner. One of the glasses still held a gulp of white wine. With the detached curiosity of a forensic scientist, she picked up the glass and tested the temperature of the wine against her lips. It was still a little cold. She felt full. She looked at the time. It was just after 9 o'clock. They'd been in Chatham for a week now. In years past, after a week away from the day-to-day concerns at Harvard, she would have been fully committed to the relaxed lifestyle that the Cape insisted on and already deep into her third or fourth book. But this year, Harvard's day-to-day schedule itself, albeit packed and demanding, had provided a structure for her that was familiar and comforting. Meetings, symposia, class times, and appointments lay like breadcrumbs that guided her through each day. Here in Chatham, she had no schedule. She slept late, ate meals at varying times, and played everything by ear. She bookended each day with her medications, she took her butterfly test each morning, and she ran every day with John. But these didn't provide enough structure. She needed bigger breadcrumbs, and more of them. She often didn't know the time of day, or what day it was, for that matter. On more than one occasion now, when she sat down to eat, she didn't know which meal she was about to be presented with. When yesterday a waitress at the sandbar put a plate of fried clams in front of her, she would have just as readily and enthusiastically dug into a plate of pancakes. The kitchen windows were open. She looked out into the driveway. No car. The outside air still held traces of the hot day and carried sounds of bullfrogs, a woman laughing, and the tide at Harding's Beach. She left a note for John next to the uncleared dishes. Walk to beach, love A. She inhaled the clean night air. The midnight blue sky was punctured with backlit stars and a cartoon crescent moon. Not as dark as it would get that night, it was already darker than it ever got in Cambridge. Without street lamps and tucked far enough in from Main Street, only lights from porches, rooms and houses, the occasional car-high beams, and the moon illuminated their beach neighborhood. In Cambridge, that amount of darkness would have made her feel uneasy walking alone, but here in this small seaside and vacationing community, she felt perfectly safe. There were no cars parked in the lot and no one else on the beach. The town police discouraged activity there at night. At this hour, there were no screaming children or seagulls, no impossible-to-ignore cell phone conversations, no aggressive worries about needing to leave in time to get to the next thing, nothing to disrupt the peace. She walked to the water's edge and let the ocean consume her feet. Warm waves licked her legs. Facing Nantucket Sound, Harding's Beach's protected waters were a good 10 degrees milder than those of the nearby beaches that faced the cold Atlantic directly. She removed her shirt and bra first, then slid off her skirt and underwear in one motion and walked in. The water, free from the seaweed that normally tumbled in with the surf, lapped milky smooth against her skin. She began to breathe to the rhythm of the tide. As she treaded lightly, floating on her back, she marveled at the beads of phosphorescence that trailed her fingertips and heels like pixie dust. Moonlight reflected off her right wrist. "Safe return" was engraved on the front of the flat, 2-inch stainless steel bracelet. A 1-800 number, her identification, and the words, "memory impaired," were etched on the reverse side. Her thoughts then rode a series of waves, traveling from unwanted jewelry to her mother's butterfly necklace, traversing from there to her plan for suicide, to the books she planned to read, and finally stranded themselves on the common fates of Virginia Woolf and Edna Pontellier. It would be so easy. She could swim straight out toward Nantucket until she was too tired to continue. She looked out over the dark water. Her body, strong and healthy, held her buoyant, treading water, every instinct battling toward life. Yes, she didn't remember eating dinner with John tonight, or where he'd said he was going. And she might very well not remember this night in the morning. But in this moment, she didn't feel desperate. She felt alive and happy. She looked back toward the beach, the landscape dimly lit. A figure approached. She knew it was John before she could identify any of his features by the bounce and size of his walk. She didn't ask him where he'd been or how long he'd been gone. She didn't thank him for coming back. He didn't scold her for being out alone without her cell phone, and he didn't ask her to get out and come home. Without a word between them, he undressed and joined her in her ocean.